And what a night we have for you. Next up, Brian Clegg joins us as we talk about his work, Final Frontier. We're going into space, and we're going to talk about that and also time travel right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome to Coast, Brian Clegg has master's degrees from Cambridge University in natural sciences and from Lancaster University in operational research, which is a discipline originally developed during the Second World War to apply the power of mathematics to warfare. We'll talk about that. He has since been widely applied to problem solving and decision making in business. He's the editor of the Popular Science book review site in the United Kingdom. We'll give you a link on that, and is a fellow of the Royal Society of Arts. Brian, quite an agenda here for you. Welcome to the show.
Good evening.
Final Frontier, the pioneering science and technology of exploring the universe. Tell me a little bit about your work.
Well, this was something I've really always wanted to do. I've written a lot of science books, but like a lot of people involved in science, one of the things that got me started when I was young, I read a lot of science fiction, I watched Star Trek, and also I was fascinated by the space program. I was in my early teens when Apollo 11 landed on the moon, and this was big news for anybody, you know, who was around back then. And it really was a huge influence on my life, and it's almost like it's gone away. You know, yes, we got the space station, but it doesn't seem to be happening like we thought it would. And so I wanted really to look into that and to see what the future might be.
We seem to be missing that passion, that drive that we had in the 60s.
Well, that's right. When we got to the moon, it was a very specific goal. And I think in a way that was the problem, that the whole aim was to get somebody on the moon. And as soon as Apollo 11 was there, although the public interest to start with was great, that started to die out, and the money really wasn't there to go much further. It's interesting. I did a survey of how many people could remember the names of the third and fourth people to land on the moon, and not that many could.
No, that's absolutely true. I know Edgar Mitchell, he was with Apollo 14, and I know Buzz Aldrin, who was, of course, on 11. But the folks in between, you're right. You're right about that. Brian, you call your work Final Frontier, and, of course, Star Trek was the final frontier as well. What will we truly do in space? Do you think we're going to go to Mars in terms of human beings going to Mars, or are we going to just stick with robotics?
Well, I guess the interesting thing about that is there are actually two commercial ventures at the moment that are hoping to get manned missions going towards Mars. One of them would just be a flypast, so it wouldn't land. It would just fly around Mars. And the other is intending to actually put people on the surface. Now, the only thing I would say about those is they are both fairly speculative, shall we say, that the dates they're planned to do it four have gone back a couple of years already, so they're hoping to start around 2018. Because one of the troubles of going to Mars is it can get an awful lot further away from the Earth, depending upon where the two planets are. And so there's only every couple of years there's a slot where you can get to Mars sensibly. And 2018, 2021, for instance, are good places to do it. They've had to move back the dates already. So yes, there's some interesting possibilities there, and I think we have to get to Mars if we are ever going to take those big steps, getting further out into the universe. But I really don't know if it's something we could do in the way that we did getting to the moon. But I think these days it has to be a combination of governments and private ventures to make this kind of thing happen.
You've got another book out there also called How to Build a Time Machine. Now, tell me about this.
Well, it sounds pretty dramatic, doesn't it? But the fact is that not many people realize that there's nothing in the laws of physics that prevents time travel. It is perfectly possible to move through time. And in fact, there is a way of doing it, but it's not very easy. And it all comes out of Einstein's special and general relativity. But it is possible, and what they're doing in the book is look at how the science makes that possible, how it happens naturally on a very small scale, and what might happen in the future.
We've got some. We've got a professor here in the United States, Brian. His name's Dr. Ron Mallett.
Yeah, I know Ron.
Okay, he wants to build a time machine. He wants to time travel. He's working with a system of, I think, of magnetics, but he's obsessed with going back into time to find his father. I've heard two different things about time travel. One is we may be able to travel somewhat into the future, but going back into the past is probably impossible. Do you agree with that?
Well, certainly going to the future is a lot easier. All you've got to do to get into the future is move quickly. And relativity basically says the faster you go, the slower time goes for you. And so if you can go very quickly, if you can get a spaceship going up near the speed of light, time pretty well stops for it, which means it's moving into the future very quickly. So you could imagine you went on the journey in a spaceship that you thought took a couple of months, you get back and it's 10 years later on the Earth.
Yeah,
that's perfectly possible. We've done that on very small scales. In fact, Voyager 1, one of the probes that's heading out of the solar system, if it came back today, would be have moved about 1.1 seconds into the future. So, you know, this is perfectly possible on a small scale. As you say, going into the past is incredibly difficult. There is a theoretical way of doing it, which is using gravity, because gravity basically warps not just space, it warps time. And if you can get a powerful enough application of gravity, or doing it in a special way, which is what Ron Mallett hopes to do on a very small scale, then in principle, you can get into the past. I ought to say, by the way, Ron Mallett isn't a crackpot. He's a physics professor. He understands very well. He never actually will get into the past himself, but that was what drove him, because when he was a boy, his father died young, and he had this urge to go back, and that's what's driven him into this aspect of physics.
Brian, let's jump ahead 1,000 years from here. 1,000 years. Do you think at that point time travel might be possible?
Well, certainly we will be a lot better at getting out there at high speed. So getting into the future, yes, definitely. But it could still well be a one-way trip, because the mechanisms to get back are so complicated. I think you're talking millions of years in the future before we have the kind of technology where we could do that on that kind of scale.
Well, that's true. But and my setup question would have been, if it is possible 1,000 years from now, is it then possible that they're coming back now and visiting us?
Well, the interesting thing about time machines is one thing we do understand, and this is one reason why Ron Mallett would never get back to see his father, is that they can only travel backwards in time to the point where they were first made. They can't go back before that, because basically what they do is they use a mechanism, again, where time's running slowly, if you like, to get into a part of the universe where time hasn't traveled, hasn't passed as far, as quickly as it is where we are now. And that means that, for instance, I'm afraid we'll never get back to, say, see the dinosaurs or great things in history, unless the only small loophole, and it's an incredibly small one, is there are some aliens out there who've already built a time machine, and we can use that. But frankly, I think that's pretty unlikely.
Well, but now you brought up an interesting question. Today, for example, the Pope said that, you know, you can't have evolution without God. God created all of this, regardless of how you think of how we evolved. Do you believe in this vastness of this universe, regardless of the multiverse theory, that there are other intelligent beings out there on planetary systems?
I think it's very likely. As yet, we have no evidence of that. But as you say, the scale of the universe is so incredible. You know, there are literally billions of stars in our galaxy alone, and there are billions of galaxies out there. The chances that we are the only place in the universe where intelligent life has evolved seems very, very small. But the downside of that scale is, you know, even if there are, say, a million intelligent life forms out there, they could search for vast periods of time and never find us. It's a very big place.
That's true. It is extremely large. But I think the soup, Brian, this primordial soup in the universe, is the same everywhere in the universe, don't you?
Well, we've certainly detected out in space some of the basic building blocks of life. So some of the chemicals that are required to start life off are present out there in space.
They're out there.
So that seems very likely.
And have we found any unusual element that we don't have here and we just don't know what it is?
No, as far as I'm aware, chemistry is the same
It's
throughout
the
the
same.
observable universe. The thing about the elements is there are some weird ones that we certainly don't find on Earth that we've managed to make. Most of them in the US. But the fact is that the periodic table of elements seems to be it. I don't think we're going to discover kryptonite or anything of that ilk out there.
Well, and let's take God out of the picture for a moment. By the way, let me preface it by saying I think it's impossible to take God out of the picture, but let's do that for sake of just this discussion for a moment. How can life start with inanimate objects? The stars and the plan and the planets, and I mean, they weren't all really alive, were they? So how could life begin from something that, to me, is not alive?
I'll be honest, I don't think science has a particularly good answer to that at this stage. I would say that, the best answer people have is that certainly it's possible to produce the building blocks. As I say, some of them are out there already. People have done experiments with combining those electricity. You assume that there is a lightning strike or something like that that make rather more complicated chemicals, but nobody has been able to make life just start from nothing. And until we can demonstrate that that's possible, as yet it's an unknown. I think if anybody tells you we know where life came from, then it's just not the case.
Is that how and why we need to include the intelligent design theory into this? Does that help answer the question?
Not really, because as far as I'm aware, intelligent design doesn't actually give you any extra information in terms of how, the mechanism of how life was started. It says that there was some form of creator, but it doesn't actually say how that creator did it, as it were, how the initial spark was there, how the thing was started. So in terms of that particular problem, I don't think that does help.
No, and you know what? We probably don't even really understand how the universe started. They talk about a Big Bang theory, but again, to talk about something so compressed, smaller than the size of a pinhead, and then it exploded to the mass we've got now, doesn't make sense to me.
Well, the thing you have to bear in mind thinking about the Big Bang is we're not talking about all the stuff in the universe as matter being the size of a pinhead, or even, in fact, much smaller than that, because back then it would just have been pure energy, and that it only actually formed in matter, if you like, as it separated out and cooled down. So in that sense, getting it into one's place is perfectly feasible. And the Big Bang makes sense is basically because what people have done is looked at how the universe is evolving. Because when we look out into space, we look back into time. We can see what the universe was like billions of years ago by looking out into space. And by doing that, we can see that the universe is expanding. And if you imagine running the movie of the universe backwards, then about 13.7 billion years ago, it should have been pretty much nothing. And so, in terms of that and lots of other evidence, it seems likely that the Big Bang is a good explanation. Obviously, we can't say for certain. Nobody was there. We can't
No.
actually say I saw it, and we can't even see it by this aspect. You can look back in time because there's a limit before light actually managed to get through the universe. But we do know that this is the most likely theory, and all science can ever do really say is this is the most likely theory we have at the moment. It explains the evidence we've got. So we'll go with that because why would you go with a less likely theory than the most likely theory?
Maybe one day we'll find out. What a answer to a question, if we can ever get that. My gosh.
We could certainly find out more.
What is, as I was reading your bio, what is the power of mathematics to warfare? What is that?
Well, this operational research, it's called operations research in the US, As you said, it was developed back in the Second World War, and the idea was to find mathematical ways of dealing with problems like, for instance, we know there's a submarine out there. What's the best pattern of depth charges to put most likely to kill the submarine? So basically, it's using things like statistics to work out how to best deploy your equipment, your men, and things of that kind. And it is still used by the military, but also, and I didn't work in the military, I worked, in fact, for an airline. Mm-hmm. It's used by many large companies to do things like schedule things, build queuing systems, basically anything where mathematics can be applied to making things work better.
You have a varied career. You also have a book out called Extrasensory, which is one of my loves, and you looked at telepathy. What did you conclude, Brian, about telepathy?
Well, I mean, telepathy is interesting. It's the only example of the things I cover in the book, which are also things like telekinesis and remote viewing, that I personally felt I had experienced, that when I was young, I had an experience that seemed to be telepathic communication. So I had a particular interest in that. And there has been a huge amount of research done. Unfortunately, a lot of the early research was very poor. It was very poor quality and very easy to fool. One of the problems we have with looking into this kind of thing is that it's something that stage magicians, for instance, are very good at faking.
Sure.
And scientists, frankly, are pretty easy to fool. If you're a good magician, it's pretty easy to fool a scientist. So we have a lot of bad evidence from the past, but I do think it's one of the few areas that holds out hope that there may be something there. There are one or two just about possible mechanisms we can imagine as to how it could work, and there are enough experiments that are giving a little bit of data that suggests something may be there, that I think it's worth exploring further. But the trouble is, most of the work that's been done has been really on tiny levels. So not so much, I got this, somebody told me something, which typically is what happens. Mm-hmm. When people experience telepathy. But it's like, I'll look at a card, what card is it? And statistically, you're doing slightly better than random chance. Now, that for me isn't good enough. I think until we can actually get communication that is, a message of some kind, we're not really demonstrating telepathy. So I think in a way, we're going about it the wrong way.
Have you ever practiced telepathy? I think we all have tried.
Well, as I say, when I was in my teens, I had an experience that I thought at the time may have been that. So basically, somebody was trying to stop me from running towards something. And I heard in my head the thing this person was saying, even though they were far too far away for me to hear them. Now, there are various reasons why that could have happened. So I'm not saying that definitely was telepathy. We can only test this kind of thing if we do it in proper controlled conditions. One of the big things about science is we say that an anecdote isn't data, if you like, that basically just because you heard somebody say something happened, it doesn't mean that is actually scientific evidence. We need to be able to pin it down and examine it in detail. But as I say, there is ever so small little bits of evidence that suggest that of the various psychic possibilities, telepathy perhaps has the most likely chance of there being something worth exploring.
I want to get your take on the military's late remote viewing program. We've had a number of guests on who have been in that program, and get your take on that, Brian, when we come back. Hey, if you're following us in Las Vegas, of course, on KXNT 840 on the AM dial and also FM, we're starting at 10 o'clock live. In case you're joining us now, that's when we are. So get your radio back and tuned in and everything else. And by the way, my trips, if you want to follow where I'm going to be in Toronto November 8th. I'll be in Laughlin, Nevada the following weekend, two events. All that information at our highlight reel at coasttocoastam.com. Welcome back, Brian Clegg with us. Brian, I've interviewed a lot of people who say that they were with the military's remote viewing program while it was going on. You've looked at that a little bit. What do you think?
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, there's one point of view, which is the kind of thing you get from the Men Who Stared at Goats, the movie and the book, which is very much that this was pretty much a disaster of a program, that the military were reaching out for anything possible and trying all kinds of things that wouldn't have any hope at all. However, there were one or two instances, I think, this guy called Pat Price, I don't know if he was one of the ones you spoke to, who did succeed in producing one or two things that seemed just about possibly worth investigating. So I'd say, you know, a lot of the stuff that came out of it, frankly, was just poor. So we had examples, for instance, of remote viewing where the people involved claimed to be describing Jupiter before the probes, particularly Pioneer 10, got out there, and practically everything they said was wrong. And almost all the stuff that was right was stuff you could get out of an astronomy book. So definitely some of the cases we know were pretty poor, but there were just one or two that looked interesting. And I personally think if remote viewing is working, what we're having here again is essentially telepathy. I do not believe and cannot see any mechanism for somebody to be able to actually see a place remotely. But what you may be able to do is see through somebody else's eyes, if you like. If there are other people there and there's a form of telepathic link, then yes, I can imagine there is a possibility of that happening.
Is it safe to say that you're a skeptic with most of this?
I come at it from a scientific viewpoint, and what I did with the book very much was to try to go straight down the middle. So most of the books I've read have either been totally accepting of everything or totally negative about everything. And I wanted to come to it with an open mind because I genuinely wanted some of this kind of stuff to be true. But equally, I do have a scientific background, and that means you need evidence. You need good, controlled evidence to prove that things happen. And what I came out of this finding was there were some things that really there seems to be no good evidence for at all, like telekinesis, for instance, moving things with your mind, which has real problems with some of the basic laws of physics. But I say telepathy, distinct possibility, and remote viewing, if it involves another person at the other end, again, a distinct possibility. But when it comes to remote viewing, seeing somewhere like Jupiter, so where there definitely isn't somebody at the other end, then all the evidence seems to be that there was nothing behind it.
Let's go to Larry in Cleveland for a question. Larry, welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Good morning, George. I haven't talked to you in a while.
Well, thanks for calling, Larry. Glad you got in.
That's all right. I'm glad too. I'm along Lake Erie delivering donuts right now.
Okay.
Brian, right?
Yep. That's right.
I didn't get Mr. Clegg, right? I was thinking about this because when I was at Youngstown State out here in Youngstown, Ohio, I took a math class and it was called finite math. And I guess that's what they call the basis, the math class for the, you know, you get the basics for the binary language, the way the computers talk. And it was kind of interesting because, George, help me out with the gentleman you had on, Cockatoo or whatever, he did a book and
yes.
He had taken up the burden.
Michio Kaku. Yes.
Yeah, and he had taken up the burden to put, I guess Einstein wanted to put everything, the reason for everything, like an equation 1 inch long or something.
That's
now,
right.
Now, that being said, when I also took an astronomy class. Now, astrology is pseudoscience, but astronomy, in the foreword of this book, it's funny, they said knowledge at one time was looked at as a tree going from the root all the way up to the different branches, but now they kind of look at it as all the branches going down into one taproot. Now, that being said, and considering that equation, I had helped this Jewish guy coming back. He was sending his son off to Israel. He was in the army. He was in the army from Israel, and he was sending his son off. And anyway, he ran out of gas, and so we met. And a lot of people, things don't happen by accident, okay, for whatever it's worth. And I know in the Old Testament, and, you know, it's interesting that the Old Testament and the New Testament are together. And it's not one book, but it's 66 books written by 40-something different authors over 1,000 years. So How do you change theory in the law? The abundance of evidence and the test of time. Now, that being said, I was sharing out of the book of Exodus pertaining to the golden candlesticks, which there's 66 little figures on. There's a lot of detail given it. Now, the Jews and the Christians don't necessarily get along. In fact, if a Jew accepts Christ as a Messiah, they're ostracized a lot of times. But I think there's a consistency, and if every letter of the Hebrew alphabet corresponds to a number, and I was sitting at dinner with this guy, and he was giving me thanks for helping him with gas, and his name was Benjamin. And he says, you know, I was figuring out your name, Larry, in the Hebrew language relative to numbers. And he says, your name is like my address where I live. I says, well, I guess God's got your number, Benjamin.
Well said. Well said. Synchronicity of mathematics. Brian, what do you think of the Bible code? Did you ever look into that?
I think that you know, that's a good example of the fact that if you have big enough numbers, you can get pretty much anything out of them. Because people since have done exactly the same thing with, for instance, Winnie the Pooh. And you can do it with that as well. The fact is, if you have enough letters, you can get messages out of them inevitably. The Bible, sure, is, as you said, you know, with a collection of so many words, it is very easy to do. So, I mean, it's a bit of fun, I think, is all you can really regard it as, the Bible code.
It's like you're a human Scrabble game, aren't you?
Yeah, that's right.
I love that stuff. So what's next for you? What are your next projects?
Well, I'm literally just finishing. It goes into the publisher at the end of the week, a book called Sci-Fi World. Because as I mentioned, when we were first talking about space travel, I was very influenced when I was young by science fiction. And a lot of scientists get involved in science because of science fiction. And what I wanted to do was look back at the kind of things that we've science fiction has said, you know, how the world's going to be, if you like, although it's never intending really to predict the future, and to say, okay, here's what we thought was going to happen, but here's what actually happened. And what we find, I think it's quite interesting, really, is that it can be wrong in two different ways at the same time. So if you look at, if you remember the movie 2001 A Space Odyssey,
sure do.
Brilliant movie, and it's still worth watching today. The computer on there, HAL, was something that we couldn't do today, even though it was set in 2001, but we still couldn't manage to have a computer that was like an intelligent human being, like HAL is. So in one sense, we're no way catching up with what was predicted, if you like, by the science fiction. But on the other hand, HAL was a huge mainframe the size of a house. And these days, our cell phones are incredibly intelligent computers, you know, that can do so many things that in 1968, when they made 2001, they had no idea that we could do. So they were imagining phones would still be, you know, pretty much as they were back in 1968. And yet we now have these amazing pocket computers that we carry That's around true. With us that do so many things.
I mean, our smartphones have more firepower than they had in the Apollo 11 command module.
Oh, vastly. Calculators have more, frankly.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it was a very small amount of computing ability they had. In fact, it's interesting when people talk about, if you like, why do we go out into space? One of the things they sometimes say is, oh, it's worth it because of all the spin-offs. And one of the technologies that really did benefit from going out into space was making computer technology smaller. But having said that, you know, it would have come anyway because, you know, of the demand for portability and that kind of thing is obviously much bigger. The fact is, you know, when you try to say, why should we be going out into space, it's really interesting, but it's not really about spin-offs. It's not even about science. We can usually do science better without people out there. It's really back down to this sort of frontier spirit. It's about getting out there. It's about the human race advancing, which is why I personally think it's so important that we do have more manned missions into space.
Let's go to John in St. Louis. Welcome to the program, John. You're on with us. Go ahead.
Oh, great. Great show. Love talking to you. I've called before. But it's a very interesting subject. But, you know, what gets me is, you know, the arrogance of mankind is huge. I mean, we are really like an ant trying to cross the road as far as this solar system stuff. We're just an ant. I think we probably might get to Mars and stuff. But, you know, Einstein said, everything's a miracle or nothing is a miracle. Now, anyone that's ever seen a child born or seen something in life existing, life could not possibly come from nothing. And, you know, and he also said, Einstein said, God doesn't play craps. So there's such, everything is so organized. And really, when you think about it, everything in life is a total, total miracle. It's a miracle that someone can speak on a telephone, make air go through there, and then other people can, their mind can pick up what you're saying, and just the whole, everything around our everyday thing is a miracle.
Yes, it sure is. You're right on that, John. There's no doubt about that.
Mankind is so arrogant that they think that they're going to do this in 10,000 years. You know, the Bible predicts Armageddon. It predicts what's going to happen. God has already placed himself in human history, and I don't think the world's going to exist that much longer. And then we're going to have what the Bible says we're going to have.
John, what do you think of privacy? A prophecy, Brian?
Sorry, was that to John or to me?
Well, John is gone. So what do you think of prophecy?
Okay. The thing about prophecy is, of course, that we look at it from the future. The only really way that we can say whether prophecy is effective or not is when we hear the prophecy now, and then the thing comes to be. So it's entirely possible that the prophecy in the Bible happened and was true, but we're not there. And so what I have to say, you know, is I'd be very interested in sort of a current day prophet, if you like, to see what the outcome is. But there's a limit to what we can say about what's happened in the past. But the other thing is, of course, that with prophecy, we do remember the prophets who get it right. You know, how many people have predicted the end of the world, and it just hasn't happened.
Every civilization has thought it was the end of the world for them.
Yeah, yeah.
It hasn't happened yet.
But the fact is, you know, there are certainly many things we don't know, and I think in a sense your caller was right that we can be a little arrogant in assuming that we can find out everything. It may be we can't find out everything. But I do think that going out into space, that exploring the universe is something that we are capable of. And, you know, I think America, in a sense, is a great example of that, that, you know, the it was the frontier at one point. It was a new place to explore. It was a place that has been transformed. And, yes, I think we could do the same eventually for the universe if we are around here to do it.
DuPont in San Diego's up with us. DuPont, go ahead. Thank you.
Thank you, George, for taking my call.
Sure.
Basically, it's a great show, and I'm very familiar for what you guys are talking about, the point of view. Well, for you guys, which you guys are saying, I'm an amateur inventor. I'm basically putting a page on LinkedIn, but I'm basically I'm coming up with technology and making cars hover with new type of magnetic levitation. And even if you list a rocket engine and something that could block radiation almost 100%. But basically, I guess now with the internet and everything, people could actually should come together in order to work in these other projects. I have other ideas that I would not like to disclose, but basically that's what I would like to add.
You know what you need to do, DuPont, is get one of those companies that will take your ideas and turn them into real business. Indeed. You know, Brian, this entire planet is going through this shift, this technological shift, but it is happening so darn fast. How do we keep up with it?
It is difficult, and I think one of the problems is that most of us don't have a good enough science education, particularly perhaps the administrators, the people in the government who are making decisions about how we fund things, and some businesses as well, just don't really understand what's happening. And I think it would help in terms of making decisions about, I don't know, say, stem cells research or something like that, or decisions about going out into space. If we all had better knowledge, better information to be able to make those decisions. But yes, it is happening quickly. When I was young, we didn't have a refrigerator. We didn't have central heating. I had friends who didn't even have a bath inside the house.
Wow, which means also no air conditioning, right?
No, yeah. Well, in the UK, we still mostly don't have air conditioning.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's probably only about 5% of houses, something like that.
Wow.
So, but then it doesn't get as hot here as it does in places over there. But the fact is that we have gone through a huge amount of change. Computers didn't exist when we were young. And it is difficult, but I think it's also exciting. You know, we have to be positive about this. We are able to do so much more. We are looking at ways of dealing with illness that have been transformed. You know, 100 years ago, doctors were basically guessing at what was possible. Now, we actually understand disease, and we are finding ways all the time of curing things. So, you know, I think there's a lot of hope as well of it as it being pretty scary sometimes.
You know, I'm amazed on this Ebola scare that, you know, Ebola's been around for years, and we don't have a vaccine. And now they're talking about coming up with two or three of them within the next few months. That's fast, isn't it?
It is. I mean, there will be experimental stuff. Well, they've already got to the stage of testing them on humans to make sure that they produce the right results. So, you know, they're working on them very quickly. I think the problem with Ebola was that basically it wasn't something that was really important for the first world. Where all the drug company money is, where all the investment is. That's why I think, for instance, the kind of thing Bill Gates does on malaria is so important, because, you know, there are these diseases that year after year kill, I mean, in the case of malaria, millions of people. But frankly, we haven't invested enough in it, because it's not so much a problem for Europe, for America. It's more a problem in the third world. And I think, you know, Ebola, because of the way it's people have got to other countries.
Where it was, nobody cared.
Yeah, that's right. But it has come to our attention more, and something now is going to be done about it pretty quickly.
Absolutely. The name of Brian's latest work is called Final Frontier. Brian, thanks for being on Coast to Coast. Appreciate it. When we come back, open lines, the subject topic. Is there a God? I'll explain when I come back.